Mental health is still one of the most misunderstood and sensitive topics to discuss in society today. Not only do people with a mental illness have to cope with their day-to-day lives, but they often have to deal with negative and stigmatising misconceptions associated with a mental health difficulty. In today's episode, we will hear from Jane Arago from Headline, the national media monitoring agency for mental health and suicide, on the work they do to promote responsible and accurate coverage of mental health and suicide-related issues within the Irish media. Conal Thompson-Coyle from Sea Change Ireland talks about the new national partnership which aims to reduce stigma and challenge the discrimination associated with mental health problems. And finally, Hearing Voices Ireland founder Brian Hartnett and Radio 4 Breakfast Show presenter Gareth O'Callaghan give their personal accounts of coping with a mental health problem.
My name is Jane Arago and I'm the Media Project Coordinator for Headline, which is a national media monitoring programme for mental health and suicide in the Republic of Ireland. It was felt that one area where we could make a big difference in suicide prevention was through reporting on mental health and suicide in the media. On a daily basis, we get in about 70 articles a day. Of these articles, we have a small percentage that are either very positive or very negative. All of the articles are logged into a database so we can see monitor trends over time. Of the negative and positive articles, then we would contact journalists to say their congratulations or that their work perhaps needs to change slightly, that perhaps the way that they're reporting might lead to imitative behaviour or that it might be stigmatising towards mental health.
My name is Khalil Thompson-Coyle and I'm the campaign manager with Sea Change. Right now it's well over 30 organisations. It's an alliance. We're working together to bring about positive change in public attitudes and behaviour towards people with mental health problems. So I suppose when we're talking about stigma and discrimination, and specifically around stigma, what we're talking about is, you know, when people use negative labels to identify people with mental health problems, I suppose it's important to say that stigma has its roots in fear and misunderstanding. Many people hold negative opinions towards people with mental health problems because they don't necessarily understand the issues involved and because they might be relying on myths or misconceptions. So I suppose what we're really trying to do is break that down and just discuss the issue, highlight that, you know, people with mental health problems can and do recover. That's such an important message for people, mm-hmm. you know, to hear that if somebody does experience some sort of mental health problem, it could be anything, that really people do recover.
Anything that would be in the media that would be stigmatizing towards mental health would be something that would lead to a misunderstanding of a type of mental illness. Perhaps mostly in relation to what we would do would be the terminology used around schizophrenia, say people calling people with schizophrenia schizophrenic or schizo or psycho. There's very often a link made between mental illness and violence and crime. There is no basis for this. There has been a very large study carried out in America earlier on this year where they took a study of 34,000 patients who had severe mental illness, and they looked at the determining factors for levels of future crime and future violence. And they looked at it across the board with people with and without mental illness. And in the top 10 rankings, mental illness only came in at number 9 and only when linked with substance abuse. So therefore, things like being male, being unemployed, being divorced, having had previous history of violence, all these kind of predictive factors, addiction, all ranked higher than mental illness, dispelling the myth that people with mental illnesses and psychosis are naturally going to progress towards violence. So I think that's really important because it makes it very difficult for someone to come forward and say, I have this severe mental illness, if other people are going to go, well, I think I've read in the paper that these people are then prone to random acts of violence. So it stops people from coming forward and getting the help that they need. It stops them from telling their friends and family what they actually have. And it kind of gives the misrepresentation that mental illness is very rare, where it's 1 in 100 people in Ireland has schizophrenia. So that's not just them who is affected. I mean, that means that all of their family, all of their friends, everyone they work with, the people that they're in college with, are also touched by it. But by people not speaking about it because of the stigma that's associated to it, people think it's not me, it's not my family, it's somebody else somewhere else. And I think the most important thing really is that people need to have less stigma so they can come forward for help. There's also problems with stigma in relation to depression, where people feel that if they come forward and say they have depression, that their friends will remove themselves from them, or particularly in a workplace, that maybe they won't get promoted or they get passed over because they feel, well, this person will be taking time off work. And in relation to suicide, the stigma is slightly different. And the stigma surrounding this would be the fact that it was only decriminalised in 1993. And prior to that, you couldn't be buried in a consecrated grave. You couldn't have a normal Catholic funeral. So therefore, it held a lot of stigma in rural Catholic Ireland. Also, the fact that it was a crime, that people could end up being charged for it.
We typically identify that there's sort of three to four main issues around stigma. The first one would be, general lack of knowledge, or could be identified as ignorance. That could be when people have very little understanding of mental health problems, and that the information that they're relying on would be actually factually incorrect. So that there's a need to convey more useful information about mental health. For example, how to recognize the features of mental health problems and where to get help. The second one would be around negative attitudes, which could be called prejudice. And that could be some sort of anxiety, fear, and avoidance of people with mental health problems. So that's quite a common experience. And also that there might be negative attitudes that exist for people with mental health problems who anticipate rejection and discrimination. And really, in effect, that they impose upon themselves a form of self-stigma. And I suppose to say that oftentimes, anecdotally, when we're working with people on the ground, that people highlight for us that it's not necessarily the experience of having a mental health problem or being unwell that is the most difficult thing to live with, but it's actually the stigma and discrimination people find so incredibly difficult and challenging to cope with. The third other form of stigma would be considered hostile behavior or actually discrimination, and that's when a person with a mental health problem aren't actually given the same rights on an equal basis with other people within society. So people might be denied rights to houses, to employment, to education, and basically experience social exclusion disadvantage.
Now, Gareth O'Callaghan and Brian Hartnett give their personal experiences of coping with a mental health difficulty.
This is Gareth O'Callaghan. I'm the Breakfast Show presenter on 4FM. I'm probably best remembered at this stage outside of radio for a book I wrote in 2003 called A Day Called Hope, which documented my own personal experiences with depression.
My name is Brian Hartnett, and I grew up in Limerick in the 70s. I went to college in Dublin in the 80s, and I got my degree. I went over to London in the late 80s. I was there for about 8 years until about 96 when I came back to Limerick, and I've been back in Limerick since. While I was in London, I started to what they call hear voices and things, but it was much more than that. I felt something had changed in my perception of reality or the world. It included hearing voices, but there was a lot more to it. I'd kind of get impressions of things going on, and it was a two-way thing. Like I would kind of communicate with this inner world as I saw it, and it would talk back to me. The difficulty, I suppose, I had was in talking about it to other people, because it was kind of frightening. It was very heavy, a lot of it, it wasn't pleasant at all. And it took me a long time to be able to find the words or to be able to talk about it. That was the biggest step, really. It was the first stage of being able to sort of vocalise what was going on. Because it was so difficult to put it into words. I mean, it's even still hard to describe, what I live with.
Years and years ago, I think way, way back to probably my teens, I just felt very insecure, very uncertain, very unsure about life generally. And it was something that stayed with me. It was like something that was sort of stuck to my back. I just couldn't shake it off. That horrible feeling of insecurity and instability, like as if I just was only really firing on kind of 65% of sort of full power, always questioning myself, very low self-esteem, just found it very, very difficult to cope from very early on. I mean, there were periods where that would lift, but it seemed to come back, and the slightest little thing would sometimes rock the boat so much that I would just sink back to that point.
eventually, when I came back to Ireland, I was kind of in a mess, really. Things had developed over the years when I was there. I was drinking more than I had been before, smoking heavily as well. I was very unfit, you know, and I had used some drugs as well and things like that. But my main sort of difficulty was this feeling of kind of alienation from Limerick, really, when I came back. I mean, between going to college in Dublin and then going to London, I'd been away for about 15 years. So my parents were very good. They looked more or less give me a roof over my head until I got myself back on track. And in college, I had studied product design, so I was trying to get back into that. And I had some success at that for a while. But I was struggling with this, this experience of this greater inner world, you know. And when I got back, my dad could see that I needed help, and he suggested we go and see somebody, and we did go and see a psychiatrist, and I was given a diagnosis, and I was given medication to take. So I didn't really want to take this stuff, because I believed that, you know, that was, this was really a kind of a spiritual thing to me, but I was willing to try this medication, and I did.
I had a very high-profile job, so consequently, it was something I wanted to keep quiet, I wanted to keep very secretive. I just felt nobody would understand me if I was to talk about it. And I knew that if I lost my job, well, the family, we'd lose our home. There'd be no money coming in, because I was the sole earner in the household at that stage, and I had three daughters who were in school, and consequently, I was aware that if I went over the edge there may not be any coming back. The job was the one motivating factor I had, tough and all as it was, but I think what got me through was the fact that I loved the music I was playing. And I think what I did was I managed to perfect it so that when I get up in the morning, my energy was always at its highest very early in the morning. And by very early, I would mean like maybe 5-6 o'clock. Now, I know some people who say they get depressed would say, I can't get out of bed in the morning. I'd no problem getting out of bed. My problem was staying out of bed so that, you know, once the show was over at 9 o'clock and whatever had to be done was done, I would either head for the pub in order to try and make myself tired enough to go to bed, or I would just be so tired some days I would just head straight back to bed and I would stay there indefinitely. But while it was very difficult living, I loved life. There were moments and there were days and times and weeks and weekends and occasions when I loved everything I had. But it absolutely terrified me. So I went to the doctor and I just said, look, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I really need help.
Eventually, what happened is that I got a job then working within the mental health system as what they call a peer advocate. And this opportunity came along to work with this organisation. And it was really came about because there was pressure on the government to have some involvement or some voice for the what they call service users or the people who use the mental health services. So they came up with this idea that they would have what they call advocates. Or peer advocates. So in other words, as a person of experience of the mental health system, medications, diagnosis, all that, I could work within the mental health system as an advocate and more or less provide a listening ear, if you like, to help out people who worked or who availed of the service. So that went okay at first, but then I began to realise that kind of my hands were kind of tied in a way as regards what I could really do and say as a peer advocate. And that was really because of the fact that the organisation I was working for were funded by the same people who were providing the service. So we weren't really independent as such. We didn't really have an independent voice. So we couldn't really advocate on behalf of our peers, mm-hmm. which is what we were supposed to be doing. So I had this dilemma for a long time where I had a wage, I had a steady job, but at the same time I felt that I was kind of not being true to myself and not being true to the people that I was supposedly there to help. I mean, unofficially, I did whatever I could for them, in particular listening, which really seemed to be the thing that people needed more than anything else. But eventually I began to realise that I had to find a different way of helping these people, because and helping myself as well, because I began to realise that they really didn't have a voice. So behind the scenes, I started a number of organisations and got involved with a number of very small voluntary organisations to help people who had, as we say, mental health difficulties. And through that kind of work in the background, I began to come to the conclusion that health wasn't just mental health on its own. It was actually a combination of physical, mental and spiritual health. So I began to realise that bringing these three elements together, the mental, the physical and the spiritual, was the way that we actually, as human beings, achieve health. And I slowly but surely rid my life of all of the sort of things which were keeping me unhealthy.
The medication I took, which I took for nearly 2 years, it gave me a little bit of an edge on life again. I can't say it cured me, because medicine doesn't cure you. You know, the body cures itself. The medicine, it can manage the discomfort, and it can numb the pain a little bit. But the hard work starts then once you get onto the medication, because then you've got to start redirecting your life and planning exactly what it is that got messed up in the first place. And it's not impossible. It just takes a little bit of work and a little bit of support. But I'd been keeping notes of my progress. And I think I said to myself, right, I want to be able to document what happens from now as I move out and as I try to create something that I know I need to, because I want to stop what's going on here. I want to design something new. And I said the only way I'm going to actually know if it's working is if I actually keep a journal. So I kept a very extensive journal. So it was shortly after the meeting that I had with Marion Finucane on RTE Radio 1 in 2002. A publisher in London, Hodder & Stoughton, approached me and said, we would like you to write the book. We heard the interview and we'd like you to document it in such a way, exactly as you told it on air, starting with the worst times, ending up with what are considerably brilliant times.
Mental health tends to focus on very narrow aspects of a person's well-being, if you like. I mean, if you, for example, tell somebody that you're depressed, or that you hear voices, or that you've got a certain illness, or that you're on medication, immediately that kind of defines you and the person themselves, unless they have a particular understanding of what's going on. They will have certain preconceptions about where you're coming from as well. And this is where the difficulty lies, and this is what stigma is all about. It's basically misunderstanding. It's making judgments of people based on what we're told.
The only reason there's a stigma attached to it is because no one understands it. They don't know what depression is. They call it an illness. It's not an illness. Cancer is an illness. Brain tumour is an illness. Chest infections, migraines, they're all illnesses. They can be cured with medication. They can be cured with radiation and chemotherapy. Depression can't be cured because pathologically you can't point to a part of the body and say, that's what's depressed. The whole system collapses. And it's a spiritual disease, not disease, but an ill-at-ease feeling that affects the spirit and the energy levels of the body. So if that's the case, it's something that affects the body can be removed by affecting the body in another way, by sort of changing what you're doing that's causing you to feel this way.
In order for me to be healthy, in order for me to achieve what I've done, I've had to look at all aspects of my life at the same time. You know, I mean, when I go for a swim, that's part of my well-being. When I go for walks or cycles, or when I eat well, or go see a film, or, you know, go to a gig or listen to music, visit friends, etc., etc. All of that plays a role in my well-being. basically, I think that what people need is help across the board. You know, if when people walk in the door who are really desperately in need of help, what they need is somebody, first of all, to listen to them. And that means sitting across from a person and listening, not giving them advice, not telling them what to do, but really just listening. And that in itself can almost make a person healthy within 10 or 15 minutes. That's the very first thing that should happen when somebody comes in the door, is that somebody should say, what's wrong with you? Tell me your story. And that's what I was doing, and that's how I feel I helped. But there has to be other things going on as well. I mean, people have all sorts of complicated issues in their lives when they get that sick. You know, it could be financial. It could be to do with, I mean, at the moment we have this crisis in our economy. The pressure on people alone, the stress of worry, etc., and all the rest of it can lead to what we would call mental illness. But again, it's the answer is listening. It's being looking after yourself as well as possible and telling people what's going on in your life and finding somebody to listen to you.
It's unfortunate that a lot of people won't talk about it because really, you know, I think your life is embellished. The quality of your life improves hugely when you know it's okay to come out and talk about this. The problem is that when you don't talk about it, the opposite happens. You become impoverished. You become locked in almost. You know, you're doing nothing for your self-esteem. You're being totally dishonest with yourself because your body is screaming at you. Get out there and talk about it. Women are quite open with each other. They're very comfortable with, you know, with the toughest, most grotesque subjects that men wouldn't touch with a barge pole. Four times as many men are more likely to commit suicide or to take their own lives. Women are as prone to get depressed as guys are, but they talk to each other about it. You know, women can sit down and talk about breast cancer and, you know, tumours and cysts and things like that. Men won't. Men will not sit down around a couple of pints and you know, talk about testicular cancer or talk about depression or suicide. They'll talk about Formula One. They'll talk about the county championships. They'll talk about golf. They'll talk about premiership football. But their health, sadly enough, they go out and they spend a whole day polishing their car, but yet they won't spend a whole day looking after their health. So I think guys have got to talk more honestly, more openly. And their friends have got to watch out for them because we all go through those dark periods and sometimes the only people who spot us before it gets too late are our closest friends. The whole issue with the finality of suicide is a very subjective argument. We can't say that everybody who thinks about taking their own lives thinks exactly the same thing. They don't. It's a different set of causes. It's a different set of reasons that they're focusing on. But ultimately, what the media really needs to do is not to stop reporting about individual cases. We have to do that. We have to keep this highlighted and keep it out there for everybody to read about. But what they need to do is they need to word it in such a way that there's a discouragement element in the article, that they actually say at some point in the article, you know, like they do at the end of a lot of the soaps, you know, if you've been upset by what you've just seen. They also need to say, you know, if you feel upset by what you're reading, please contact, please phone one of the helplines, because what it is it's presenting a lifeline while also presenting the hard, cruel news of the day.
The first thing that needs to be promoted is the idea that when people get really, really bad, they need a break. I mean, the idea of a retreat, we have to move away, I think, from the idea that retreats are necessarily just about religion, for example. You know, I mean, a retreat means a break. It means a place of recovery. And again, these places of recovery should be where people can look at their mind, body, soul balance and rest, eat well, have somebody to listen to them. And if they want to talk about spiritual, mental, physical stuff and all the rest of it and look at all of those aspects of their life, this is the place to do it. So a retreat, first of all, is something that I would see as a good answer to this.
John O'Donoghue, a great friend of mine, sadly passed away a couple of years ago. John, famous poet and philosopher, and I remember saying to John in Galway one night, what is depression? And he said, you know what depression is? He says, it's the painful longing of the neglected soul. And You know, he said, the problem is, he said, people know what that neglected longing is, but the minute you start talking about someone's soul, people run and slam the door behind them. They don't want to know about it. They think religion. It's nothing to do with that. He said, what keeps us alive is the fact that each of us has a spiritual energy that's fired up by the soul. And, you know, when we come to understand that it's perfectly acceptable to believe that and to talk about it, well, it's amazing, that, you know, what opens up in front of us.
There is life after depression or bipolar, or, you know, people can recover and go on to have children and happy lives.
Feeling low and feeling discouraged and feeling your self-esteem taking a hammering, that's a clear indication that something's wrong in your life and you just need to change the direction. You need to figure out, what is it I need to do so that I don't have to feel this way anymore?
One in four of us will experience a mental health problem at some point in our lives. It's a real issue. We all experience mental health, just as we experience physical health. And everyone, all of us, have the power to help decrease the stigma and discrimination, because it's really just about changing our own minds and how we view people.
You've been listening to episode 4 of Mind Matters. Tune in again next week for the 5th and final installment of this series, which looks at some of the positive and alternative ways that you can maintain a healthy mind. Mind Matters was written and produced by Wired FM. The series was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland through the Sound and Vision Scheme. Wired FM would like to thank all those who participated in the making of this series. And for further information on any of the matters discussed in this episode, please log on to www.wiredfm.ie.